Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. A Taiwanese commercial airplane carrying 58 people clipped a bridge and crashed into a river outside the capital, Taipei, killing at least 23 people, according to state media. Dashcam videos and images posted on social media showed the TransAsia Airways ATR-72 at a 90-degree angle as its wing grazed the bridge and plunged into the shallow Keelung River. The plane narrowly missed plowing into several nearby high-rise apartment buildings. Rescuers in several boats surrounded the partially submerged plane and have pulled many of the passengers to safety, including a young child. Jordan executed two militants at dawn Wednesday, responding to the Islamic State group's gruesome killing of a Jordanian pilot captured after his plane went down during a mission targeting the fighters in Syria. Authorities hanged an Iraqi woman sentenced to death for her role in a 2005 suicide bombing in Amman, and another Iraqi with ties to al-Qaeda. U.S. President Barack Obama, who met briefly with King Abdullah, said the video was just one more indication of the Islamic State's viciousness and barbarity. Hundreds of Boko Haram fighters crossed into Cameroon on Wednesday, clashing with Chadian and Cameroonian soldiers deployed to fight the Nigerian militants. Witnesses say the fighters entered the town of Fotokol on the Cameroon-Nigeria border and attacked Chadian military positions. Heavy gunfire was reported in the area. Chad says its soldiers repelled a Boko Haram attack in Fotokol Tuesday, chased the fighters into the Nigerian town of Gambaru. There was no independent confirmation of the casualty figures. This is VOA News. The European Union's foreign policy chief has called for an immediate truce in eastern Ukraine, where fresh fighting has killed three people, according to officials. Witnesses saw at least three bodies outside a hospital that was hit by shells in the rebel-held city of Donetsk on Wednesday. In a statement, the EU's Federica Mogherini said the fighting, provoked by the continued separatist offensive, notably around Debaltseve, is causing great human suffering and undermines all efforts aimed at a political solution. Mogherini called for the establishment of a local temporary truce for a minimum of 3 days, taking of immediate effect. Fighting has raged in the self-declared separatist regions of Donetsk and Luhansk since the rebels launched a new offensive late last month, and peace talks in Belarus between the two sides collapsed Saturday. Seven people are dead and about a dozen others injured after a crowded commuter train struck a sports utility vehicle that had stopped on the tracks after going through a railway crossing outside of New York City. The collision occurred Tuesday evening in the town of Valhalla, about 32 kilometers north of New York on the Metro North Railroad. Authorities say the driver of the Jeep Cherokee had stopped to inspect her vehicle after the crossing safety gates came down on top of it. The train hit the car before the driver could continue across the tracks. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo told reporters late Tuesday, after visiting the crash site, that the driver of the SUV and six passengers on the train were killed. Somalia says a U.S. drone strike on Saturday killed its target, senior al-Shabaab militant leader Yusuf Digg. The government said in a statement Wednesday that Digg died with other al-Shabaab commanders in the airstrike in the southern town of Dinsor. A source in the militant group confirmed Digg's death to VOA Somali service. The Somali government says Digg, who was al-Shabaab's chief of external operations, was responsible for planning attacks inside and outside Somalia and was the brain behind the attacks. Myanmar has slammed a visiting United Nations official for using the term Rohingya to refer to a beleaguered ethnic minority group that the government does not officially recognize. In a statement Wednesday, the office of President Thein Sein unequivocally rejected the use of the term Rohingya by Yang He Lee, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar. The majority Buddhist country, also known as Burma, does not recognize the existence of Rohingya ethnicity. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Chadian army engaged in heavy clashes with Boko Haram militants along the Nigeria-Cameroon border on Tuesday. Chad says more than 200 Boko Haram fighters were killed in the battle. More fighting was reported in the area Wednesday.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. Details coming up. Also in the news, Somalia says a U.S. drone strike on Saturday killed its target, senior al-Shabaab militant leader Yusuf Deeg. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Somalia says a U.S. drone strike on Saturday killed its target, senior al-Shabaab militant leader Yusuf Deeg. The government said in a statement today that Deeg died with other al-Shabaab commanders in the airstrike in the southern town of Dinsor. A source in the militant group confirmed Deeg's death to VOA's Somali service. The Somali government says Deeg, who was al-Shabaab's chief of external operations, was responsible for planning attacks inside and outside Somalia and was the brain behind the attacks. It says the planned explosions and suicide missions was central figure within al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab's attack outside Somalia include the 2013 assault on Nairobi's Westgate Mall, in which more than 60 civilians died, and a 2010 bombing in Uganda's capital Kampala that killed more than 70. The U.S. has targeted the al-Shabaab leadership in a series of airstrikes. In late December, the Defense Department confirmed that a U.S. strike killed the group's intelligence chief, Tahil Abdi Shakur. Al-Shabaab's supreme leader, Ahmed Abdi Godain, was killed in a U.S. airstrike on September 1st. Nigerian officials reported today they have joined Chad in launching joint airstrikes on a large number of towns and villages now held by Boko Haram extremists. The targets include locations in and near the Sambisa Forest, where Boko Haram forces have established camps. The report follows other accounts of Chadian ground forces fighting Boko Haram within Nigerian borders. And according to the reports, the Chadian army engaged in heavy clashes with Boko Haram militants along the Nigeria-Cameroon border yesterday. Chad says more than 200 Boko Haram fighters were killed in the battle. More fighting was reported in the area today. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
Witnesses say hundreds of suspected Boko Haram fighters crossed over from the Nigerian town of Gambaru early Wednesday and attacked border villages in Cameroon. Mal Musa Ledu Blaise, a Cameroonian journalist near the town of Fotokol, told VOA the militants have been provoked by Tuesday's attack on their positions in Gambaru by Chadian forces.
Ils étaient positionnés là-bas. Donc les gens ont commencé à tirer sur eux à partir de Gambaru.
He says the Chadian army attacked Boko Haram's locations in the northern town of Gambaru after insurgents disguised as passers-by shot at hundreds of people and killed three of their soldiers in Fotokol on the border with Nigeria. He adds that the Chadians used their military helicopters to bomb Gambaru. Mal Musa says the insurgents have been attacking mostly Chadian military posts since they crossed over to Cameroon early Wednesday. He says Cameroonian soldiers have mobilized to help the Chadians fight the insurgents.
No, ils étaient en appui, mais ils ne sont pas entrés sur le territoire nigérien.
He says Cameroonian soldiers supported the Chadians from a distance but did not get into the Nigerian territory. He says there was no shooting between the Cameroonian army and the militants, but there was serious shooting between Boko Haram fighters and Chadians. Cameroon military spokesman Colonel Didier Bajek says Cameroonian and Chadian troops have been deployed to Fort Okol to fight the insurgents. He says they will be able to engage Boko Haram until a regional force agreed upon at last week's African Union summit is operational.
De solidarité agissante. Le Tchad s'est tenu tout à fait disposé à nous soutenir immédiatement dans la lutte contre Boko Haram.
He says there will be very difficult moments for Boko Haram in the days ahead with the creation of a regional force of 7,500 troops against the insurgents. He says Chad and Cameroon reached bilateral agreements on how to jointly combat Boko Haram after Cameroon's president, Paul Biya, calls for international support to destroy the militant group and that Chadian and Cameroonian soldiers have been fighting the enemy together. African Union experts are expected to meet in Yaoundé Thursday to draw up strategies on how the force will operate. Chad supported Cameroon after President Paul Biya appealed for a coordinated international response to Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A media watchdog group is calling on the Nigerian government to ensure that international journalists are allowed to cover the February 14th elections. The Committee to Protect Journalists says a number of reporters are having difficulty getting visas to enter the country. CPJ says only a few days remain for journalists to enter Nigeria and be accredited. Peter Nkanga is CPJ's West Africa representative from Abuja. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about the difficulty journalists are having getting visas.
Truthfully, I have to tell you that CPJ's concerns are what everybody's concern should be when you want to see that a process is being followed and adhered to and is transparent and credible. And the process we are talking about now is the presidential elections coming up February 14th. Especially that and the other governorship and state parliamentary elections coming up February 28th. As I'm talking to you, CPJ has been able to get in touch and contact, and people have reached out to over 20 journalists who have applied for visa to come to Nigeria, some of them as far back as September 2014. And the reasons being given for the delay in granting this visa is that they need security clearance, which is understandable and appreciated. Yes, it should be done. But what is going on? Nobody seems to have an idea. Journalists who have actually been told that they have been granted their visa, but embassies are not giving them the visa. People who have actually had visa in the past have visited Nigeria several times, talking about journalists from credible, internationally recognized media outlets around the world, France, England, the UK, South Africa, Nairobi, Netherlands, Japan, Asia, everywhere, Canada. It's the world over, so we are concerned that why does the government seemingly not want to allow journalists to take part in a process like the elections, which we believe everybody wants to be sure that it's free and fair.
Have you been able to have direct contact with a Nigerian government official about this?
Yes, I have. I've spoken to several government officials in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of Information, in the Nigerian Immigration Service, in the Presidency, even up to the National Security Advisor's Office. I have. And that's why I say it's foggy, because the context that has been said is being processed at the Office of the National Intelligence Agency. That is under the presidency. Repeated calls, SMS. I've reached out to the staff who have said they will pass my message on to those concerned. I call back. They say that I've not been able to. You know, it's just one story after the other. And it's worrisome. Why is it worrisome? Because by the INEC, that's the Electoral Commission, has just released its media accreditation guidelines. And it states categorically that all journalists should apply to be accredited by February 6, 2014. That is 2 days from now. And the INEC rep told me that, Peter, look, that's the challenge. That's going to be a problem because they have to be on ground to apply to be accredited. These journalists have to be in Nigeria. And how can they be in Nigeria if they don't granted a visa?
Now, I understand that some international journalists have been granted access. Is that correct?
Yes, there are some. That's not to say that we don't have journalists, foreign journalists in Nigeria already. We do. And the process for accreditation with INEC has just started. So we do have those. Well, we're talking about a host of others.
I understand that the Committee to Protect Journalists has also tried to contact the National Intelligence Agency, which is responsible for the security clearance and approval of the journalists. Is that correct?
National Intelligence Agency is under the Office of the President. So our reaching out has been through the Office of the President.
CPJ is also concerned about the safety of some journalists. You say at least five local journalists on Monday had been attacked in Gombe State.
Yeah, and that's also a very big concern to this run-up to the elections, because what we are seeing more often than not is the prevalent use of inciting language by politicians and their partisans. And this has genuine fear or concern by everyone that this could degenerate even to the point of electoral violence. And we are already seeing it in the run-up to the elections. A bomb went off. Several bombs have gone off, not just this bomb. Several have been going off, both in the south part of Nigeria and the northern part of Nigeria. And it so happened that journalists this time around became the target of thugs who believe that they have to take out any form of grievance by attacking anyone and everyone perceived to be an opposition or just anyone that can be an easy target. And that's what electoral violence is about. And that's the concern that journalists who will be there to document this electoral violence, journalists themselves become the targets of this electoral violence, because nobody, you remember, will not want to be documented as being the one who did an attack or committed a violation or an offense. So if they see you, the journalist, documenting it, you are obviously going to be the target. I am concerned. Everyone should be concerned.
Peter Nkanga is CPJ's West Africa representative from Abuja. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua. A judge in Cairo today sentenced 230 secular activists active in Egypt's 2011 uprising to life in prison. Among those sentenced was Ahmed Douma, a leading figure in Egyptian protests over the past 4 years. Douma was sentenced earlier to 3 years in prison on charges of rioting and inciting violence during protests in 2011. These so-called cabinet clashes with police lasted 4 days. The demonstrators were protesting the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces' appointment of a new prime minister in 2011. Douma was also instrumental in last year's protests against a new law that allows the government to try civilians in military courts. Today's sentences are the heaviest yet against secular activists who spearheaded the 2011 uprising in Tahrir Square. Those protests forced the resignation of Hosni Mubarak, who was president for 30 years. Only two-thirds of the funds pledged to fight the Ebola pandemic in West Africa have reached the affected countries 10 months after the outbreak were reported. A study published by the British Medical Journal tracked pledges of more than $2.8 billion and found that only $1.9 billion had been delivered. Karen Gripin, an assistant professor of global health policy at New York University and the author of the report, says in a statement that those delays may have contributed to the spread of the virus. Gripin says early estimates of the cost of the fight against Ebola were too low and the donations were not deployed quickly enough. In her statement, she did not identify who was responsible for the delays. In Liberia, Doctors Without Borders has stopped testing an antiviral treatment drug. The Medical Emergency Service, also known as MSF, ended testing of the drug on patients after Chimrix, the manufacturer, said it would stop production. University of Oxford officials supervising the trial said the drop in the number of new cases makes it difficult to carry out effective studies. There is no licensed treatment for the Ebola virus disease that has taken approximately 9,000 lives in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. In Sierra Leone, some public officials are worried that the travel ban was lifted too early. President Ernest Bai Koroma ended the ban to improve economic trade as the numbers of new cases of Ebola began to decline. The mayor of Freetown says Mr. Koroma's decision was premature and could prove disastrous. "We do not know who is safe and who is not," said Franklin Bode Gibson, the chairman of the Eastern Kinema District. Dr. Sensei Mansare says lifting the travel restrictions is a serious blunder at this point in time. A new study says the vast majority of unwanted pregnancies every year could be avoided if women had access to modern contraceptive methods. The findings appear in the online version of Human Reproduction. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The study used demographic and health surveys in 35 low- and middle-income countries. That represents one-third of the world's population. It says 15 million of the 16.7 million unwanted pregnancies every year could be prevented. Dr. Howard Sobel is one of the authors. He's regional coordinator of the Reproductive, Maternal, Newborn, Child, and Adolescent Division at the World Health Organization's Western Pacific Regional Office. He spoke from the Philippines capital, Manila.
We looked at the risk of getting pregnant if they did not use any contraceptives, and we looked at the risk of getting pregnant if they used traditional methods like calendar rhythm method and withdrawal, meaning that before ejaculation, the person pulls out. And we compared that to those that used modern methods.
Modern methods include pills, implants, injectable contraceptives, and IUDs, or intrauterine devices. Dr. Sobel says many women who have unintended pregnancies face what he calls a stark future.
Let's just take their life potential. For every child that you have in a poor family, it's another mouth to feed, meaning that you have to spend more of the money toward that. Poor people end up having more difficulty in getting their children through school. They have higher dropout rates, lower educational potential, and ultimately lower earnings potential. So the cycle of poverty continues.
And then he says there's the health risk.
We're looking at a very high rate of increased risk for the mother of dying and being malnourished. We're looking at the same type of risk for every child also. When you have undesired pregnancies, it affects the family, it affects governments, and it affects society. If we could address this, then we could have a dramatic improvement in basically development worldwide.
He says greater access to modern contraception would also result in a large drop in the number of abortions. The study says women were asked to give the main reason for not using contraception.
The top reasons are really around myths and misperceptions. The number one and number two reason, which we lumped together, is fear of side effects and health concerns. The risk is not very high of health effects. Certainly getting pregnant, it's going to be something very taxing for anybody. And if it's an undesired pregnancy or two or three, that obviously has a bigger impact on health.
Dr. Sobel says many of the modern contraceptives have a very low risk of side effects. Other reasons given for not using modern contraception include underestimating the risk of pregnancy, infrequent sex, the idea that pregnancy is determined by fate, religious opposition, and concern about the cost.
There's a lot of low-cost contraceptives. They require repeated use and availability. But even in some of the more expensive ones, like the long-term reversible methods, such as implants, we're looking at a cost that's $14 or $15 a person, which lasts 3 years or so, versus having an undesired pregnancy. Well, I think that anybody, even in the poorest of countries, would agree that this is something that would be cost-effective for the family as well as everyone else.
Dr. Sobel and his fellow researchers say universal access to reproductive health was one of the Millennium Development Goals, but they say it is the goal that is most off track. The MDGs expire at the end of this year, and will be replaced by the Sustainable Development Goals. Sobel says strategic investment in methods like implants, though expensive up front, are far less costly to families, governments, and society than having larger families due to undesired pregnancies. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The leaders of South Sudan's warring factions signed a peace deal on February 1st in the latest attempt to end a conflict that has raged for over a year. Analysts say although this deal leaves a number of important issues unresolved, it could still be more promising than previous peace agreements. Hilary Hewler has more from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
The newest agreement between South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar, signed after the African Union summit in Addis Ababa, includes few concrete details. The two have agreed on a ceasefire until they resume talks February 20th and have promised to finalize a peace deal by March 5th. But while the goals laid out are encouraging, experts aren't convinced that these negotiations will be enough to end a civil war that has already claimed more than 10,000 lives. There are signs that East Africa's Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, which mediated the agreement, may be losing patience with the two leaders. Neither has shown himself willing to compromise in the past. IGAD mediator Seyou Mesfin insisted at the signing, if either side broke this latest agreement, there would be consequences.
This time, if any of the parties violate this commitment and the agreement of cessation of hostilities, IGAD leaders have pledged to take severe action, but also to report the acts of violation to the African Union Peace and Security Council, and as well as to the United Nations Security Council on who has violated, and calling also to join taking action as IGAD is also doing so.
The two leaders have signed at least three peace agreements in the past, all of which were violated. But analyst Abraham Awolich of the Juba-based research organization The Sud Institute says signs from the government side indicate this one just might be different.
It seems like the government is committed based on the reports that we have seen, but we cannot tell what is going on the other side of the equation. So hopefully it is not like the framework agreement that they signed in May last year. This one, they have put some meat on it and they have said specific targets for when they can achieve this. So I'm hopeful, but I'm also cautious.
Awolich says that both sides' attitude will be crucial in determining whether the agreement has any chance of success.
There are a number of issues that we have to watch. First is the commitment of the parties to the cessation of hostilities. Number two is the rhetoric that you receive from both sides. If the rhetoric changes and they are talking more in reconciliatory terms, then know that the parties have committed fully to resolving the crisis.
After the signing, Machar told reporters he and Mr. Kiir still disagree on several key points, including the structure of a transitional government. A number of contentious issues like this have been left vague, says Awolich, and there's no reason to assume that either side will agree to compromise.
Of course, there are so many blank spaces in the agreement. One cannot guarantee that they are going to agree on all this. The parties seem to have a tendency to harden their positions whenever they are given an opportunity to go on recess and consult. The hardliners seem to veer off the negotiators from the path that they established.
UN Secretary of State Ban Ki-moon issued a statement Tuesday saying sustainable peace is impossible unless Mr. Kiir and Machar place the interests of the civilian population above their own. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A U.S. drone strike has killed a senior al-Shabaab militant leader. And the Chadian army is engaged in heavy clashes with Boko Haram militants along the Nigerian-Cameroon border. Coming up, music from South Africa. And in our feature segment, how best to bring women's issues to the forefront in Senegalese politics. I'm Hayes Wuhim, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Hayes.
Sonny, I understand you're kicking off again with the Nations Cup football.
Yeheus, let's kick off in Equatorial Guinea's port city of Bata. That's where later Wednesday evening at 1900 UTC, the Leopards from the Democratic Republic of Congo will play the Elephants from Ivory Coast in the first semifinal at the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament. For a preview, we're joined once again by our African football guru, David Legg.
Well, it's an interesting one, Sonny, in that it's no surprise that Ivory Coast have reached the semifinals on the sunny side of sport. I think about 5 or 6 weeks ago, we mentioned them as potential winners. But on the other hand, the Democratic Republic of Congo, now that is a surprise. They were not at all impressive in the group stage. In fact, they didn't win a single game. They drew 3 matches. And became only the 3rd country to reach the quarterfinals without a victory. Another one, ironically, came in the same 2015 tournament. Guinea also involved in 3 draws. Tommy, on paper, you would have to say Ivory Coast must be favorites to reach the final. They've sort of slowly but surely come to the boil. Draws against Guinea and against Mali, and then a 1-0 victory over Cameroon in a do-or-die clash enabled them to reach the quarterfinals. And then they really came good against the top-ranked African team, Algeria, winning by 3-1. And Wilfred Bonny, a recent signing by Manchester City from fellow English Premier League club Swansea City, he really came to the fore in the Algerian match with 2 powerful-headed goals. He looks a real threat to the Congolese. Now, the Congolese, when they did get to the quarterfinals, were trailing their neighbors, Congo-Brazzaville, by 2 goals. With 65 minutes gone, and then the Congolese woke up, and what we saw from then on will surely have concerned the Ivorian manager, Herr Bernard. The Congolese scored 4 goals. They were foiled of 2 others by the woodwork. They looked really impressive, especially in Mbokani. He's a huge striker, and this is going to be a physical battle, Sonny, because both sides sport a lot of guys that they wouldn't be out of place playing in American football. These are big, big, strong boys. And it promises to be a really good, interesting semifinal. I could see it even going to extra time and penalties. But if you look at logic, if that's to be used in this Cup of Nations of many surprises, you would have to give a slight edge to the Ivory Coast Elephants. And that, interestingly, could set up a repeat of the 1992 final, in which they beat Ghana after a marathon penalty shootout.
David, the Elephants of Ivory Coast feature the Touré brothers, Yaya and Kolo. And Kolo has said this will be his last Nations Cup, David, his last international competition for Ivory Coast.
That's right, Sonny. This is definitely his swan song, and I believe him. I mean, I'm very impressed with Didier Drogba. When he retired, he really did retire, unlike a lot of these African superstars who seem to think you have to have at least 6 retirements before you actually hang up your boots for once and for all. You can think of, for example, Samuel Eto'o. I mean, how many retirements has he had from the Cameroon team? But Kolo Touré, a real ambassador, an absolute gentleman, a great defender. He still plays occasionally for Liverpool in their first team. And, of course, he is, unfortunately, overshadowed a lot by Yaya, because Yaya is the midfield dynamo. He's the guy who plays for Manchester City and is one of the real stars of the English Premier League. But I've got the utmost respect for Kolo Touré, and I've often thought One of the great things, if Ivory Coast do go on to win this tournament, is that finally, after so many failed attempts, Kolo Touré will get a gold medal, and nobody, but nobody, deserves it more than he does.
David, goal scoring seems to be picking up in these knockout rounds. How about an update on who's in contention for the Golden Boot Award?
Yeah, good point, Sonny. At one stage, it looked like the winner of the Golden Boot was going to be about 30 players scoring one goal each. Nobody was emerging as a prolific scorer, but you're right. We're now getting some goals from the individuals. Now, on three goals, you've got Akachi of Tunisia, but he, of course, is finished. Tunisia are out. You've got Balbao of Equatorial Guinea. Well, he's got another two matches to come, Sonny, because even if they lose to Ghana in the semifinals, they will have in Malabo on Saturday a third-place playoff. So you can put a couple of dollars on Balbao as possibly finishing as the winner of the Golden Boot. And then you've got a third player on three goals, but he's also out of contention now. That's Bafuma from Congo Brazzaville. So of those three players, Balbao, the only one, is still in the competition. And with two matches to go, and also the fact that he is the penalty taker for Equatorial Guinea, I guess there's a reasonably good chance that he can score some more goals. And then on two goals each, Sonny, you've got Atsu and Andre Ayew of Ghana. And they're, of course, very much still in contention. You've got Bokila Mbokani of the Democratic Republic of Congo, also still in contention. And you've got Bonny and Gradel from Ivory Coast. So all of those six players on two goals each, they still have a guaranteed two matches to go. They'll either play in the semi-final and the final, or else in the semi-final and the third-place playoff. And it's quite interesting, looking at the statistics, that you get an awful lot of goals, Sonny, in that third-place playoff. And that, of course, has been basically owned in recent years by Mali. They beat Ghana in 2012 and 2013 in the third-place playoffs. But, of course, this time Mali not getting past the group stage after that drawing of lots.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, providing us with more Soccerlicious Nations Cup analysis.
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Ed Kowalski for the Classic Rock Show, where each week we spotlight the great album rock and roll of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Wednesday at 21 hours Universal Time. Join me for the Classic Rock Show, 21 hours Universal Time Wednesdays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Thanks, Ed, and keep on rocking. Host Equatorial Guinea advanced to Thursday's Nations Cup semifinal against Ghana after a controversial 2-1 victory over Tunisia in extra time. The Tunisians were furious after the Mauritian referee called a penalty in the closing seconds of regulation extra time. Javier Balboa equalized for Equatorial Guinea with a penalty shot, and then he scored the game winner in the 102nd minute. In the wake of the tumultuous match, the Confederation of African Football has issued several sanctions, including penalties for the referee, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Sichan Rajendra Prasad of Mauritius has been sanctioned for the manner in which he handled the quarterfinal tie between Equatorial Guinea and Tunisia last Saturday, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, revealed in Bata. According to the CAF referees committee, Rajendra Prasad handled the match poorly, failing to calm and properly control the players. Consequently, he will not play any further role at the Nations Cup. He has been suspended for 6 months and delisted from the CAF Elite Referees Panel. Staying in Bata, the CAF disciplinary board has come down hard on the Tunisia Football Federation for the violent conduct of their players and the serious allegations made in letters from the Tunisia Football Federation president Wadi Jari. At the end of the Equatorial Guinea-Tunisia quarterfinals, which the hosts won 2-1, Tunisian players insulted and tried to physically assault the match referee. Their vandalism included breaking a door in the locker room area and damaging a fridge. Tunisia Football Federation head Wadi Jari wrote to CAF alleging that they are biased against Tunisia and lack sporting ethics. CAF has asked Equatorial Guinea to submit the estimate cost for the repairs to damages caused by the Tunisian players. CAF will forward them to Tunisia and make sure that they cover the costs of the repair. The Tunisia Federation has also been fined $50,000 for the violent conduct of their players. CAF has given Tunisia until midnight tomorrow Thursday to submit a letter apologizing for the insinuation that the continental body is biased against them and lack decorum. Alternatively, Tunisia should provide irrefutable evidence to back their claim. CAF has indicated that failure to receive a formal response from Tunisia may lead to their national team being excluded from the 2017 Nations Cup. Meanwhile, the CAF disciplinary jury has fined Equatorial Guinea $5,000 for the pitch invasion and aggressive conduct by some of the Equatorial Guinea fans at the end of the quarterfinals between Equatorial Guinea and Tunisia. CAF reminds Equatorial Guinea of their responsibility as hosts to provide the required security for the smooth running of the remaining fixtures at the tournament.
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Let's check out a few Facebook comments about the Nations Cup. King Boy Okworo, sporting one of those much-coveted VOA T-shirts on my Facebook page, says he wants Ivory Coast to win its second Nations Cup title. In King Boy's words, "I like Yaya Toure and Drogba." Keep in mind, King Boy, Didier Drogba announced his retirement from Ivory Coast's national team almost 6 months ago. Another Nigerian, Onyembi Chris Ugochukwu, writes, "The Ivorians will have themselves to blame if they don't win the Nations Cup this time." And Chris adds, "Nigeria wishes you guys the very best." Kenneth Uko Okafor says he sees an Ivory Coast versus Ghana Nations Cup final on Sunday, and he wants Ivory Coast to win its first trophy in 23 years. Keep in mind, VOA Nations Cup fans, the Black Stars of Ghana have had an even longer drought when it comes to Nations Cup glory. Ghana's last title was in 1982. And as David Legg mentioned earlier, should Ghana and Ivory Coast advance to Sunday's match, it would be a rematch of the 1992 final in which the Ivorians beat Ghana in a marathon penalty shootout. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Woohee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, how best to bring women's issues to the forefront on Senegalese politics. And next, one of the so-called lost boys of Sudan, who mastered the game of chess and now teaches it to children in New York City. But first, some music. Here is Zahara of South Africa with Lolwe.
Now we'll see Zah. We'll
Zahara of South Africa with Lolwe. The Women Empowerment Network in Senegal recently held a forum with elected female leaders in the country to address how best to bring women's issues to the forefront of Senegalese politics. Malin Niang is the monitoring and evaluation specialist of USAID's Parliamentary Assistance and Citizen Engagement Program. He tells Ricky Shryock the group will present the findings of meetings it had with women throughout the country to find out what their biggest daily challenges are.
So basically the main issues that we noted were health issues, education issues, women empowerment issues, and I believe that the forum will be for us the opportunity to give specifically all the recommendations and all the challenges that have been identified and depicted during the forums that we organized in the regions.
How actively politically are women in Senegal in the parliamentary process, and what kind of things are you guys looking to do to make women have a louder voice?
Something that is very important is to see the role that the parliament plays in our country. It is the main tool for advocacy. And something we have noted actually during these events was that a lot of parliamentarians didn't know exactly what were the problems that people who elected them were facing. So just to give you some statistics, we organized a survey after the forums just to ask women how many of them had ever had the chance to meet someone that they elected, just to inform them on the problems. More than 90% said that they never met them. So with this initiative, first of all, we worked on an advocacy document, and second of all, we worked on sensitizing the parliamentarians on the specific issues that the people who elected them are facing. And we believe that from that moment, we give them this advocacy document and that we put the emphasis on the major actions that we want them to take, they will be able to advocate for specific measures. I think it's going to be late for now because the budget is already voted. In the perspective of the 2016 budget, they will be able to propose specific and well-thought public policies that will for sure improve the situation in which a lot of Senegalese women leave.
In Senegal, what percentage of the voting population is women? And what percentage of women vote?
Around 52-53% of the population is women. So you see the relatively important part of the women in the population. It is a country in which women participation, both as electors and as candidates, is very important. As you've seen with the law that has been passed 2 or 3 years prior to the 2014 elections, the law on parity, women participation has increased and it has improved. But now a problem we are facing is also a problem of women capacitation, building their skills, reinforcing their skills. Because now that we have fought for them to access public positions, it is important that we fight for them to be able to fill these positions. And this forum actually is also going to contribute to that, giving women the tools to effectively participate. They have been voters, and now from being voters, they are public officials, but we want them to perform as well as men in public positions, or even better than men.
Malin Niang is the monitoring and evaluation specialist of USAID's Parliamentary Assistant and Citizen Engagement Program. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Dakar. In the mid-1980s, thousands of Sudanese boys escaped the country's civil war by walking for weeks, then for months, and finally for more than a year, up to 1,500 kilometers across three countries. The so-called lost boys of Sudan had little time for games, but one of them later mastered the game of chess and now teaches it to children in the New York area. VOA's Bernard Schussman has his story.
It's very important to control the center of the board.
His name is Majur Jawach. He has made the leap from being a refugee in Africa to a master chess champion in the United States. His job is to share his expertise with students in public and private schools, chess camps, and other events. During Sudan's civil war, Jawach, a Dinka tribe member, was forced out of the country with 20,000 other so-called lost boys. He fled to Ethiopia, then to Kenya, where he was in a refugee camp for 8 years. It was in Kenya that he learned to play chess. Jawach describes a dangerous journey in which half the boys did not survive. To eat, they had to kill wild animals.
There was animals while we were walking, and it was about 1,000-mile walk. And there was sometimes there's no water. And in the case when we were in Ethiopia, we have to go back and then cross the river. And in that river, a lot actually drowned. People who didn't know how to swim.
Jawach arrived in the United States in 2004 and began working as a security guard. Winning a chess tournament gave him this teaching opportunity. Jawach believes chess helps prepare young people for life.
Some kids are not interesting, so it's your job to make them like the game, to explain to them what chess is going to help them with. Like, I can tell you, this game will give you passion and help your calculation, so it will prove your math skill.
Public School 153 second grade teacher Julie Cathone agrees.
It definitely helps them with math skills, and it helps them thinking ahead and planning before they make a move, and that's the key to chess.
And is that the key to learning?
And that is the key to learning, definitely.
The school's principal, Megan Kelly, says Jawach and chess have made a big difference.
What a role model. I mean, when you think about just overcoming, when we think about finding what you love and turning that into your life's work, the way that he interacts with the children is amazing.
Jawach enjoys the freedom he has in the United States as much or more than his love for chess, but his passion is playing and teaching chess to youngsters. His boss, Michael Proper, says Jawach has one great advantage.
I think he's believable. I think that they look at him and he's so unassuming that they feel like they can do what he's doing and that it's plausible to them. that as great as he is and as humble as he is, that perhaps they can be too. And that's a great advantage for a coach to have, to be able to come in. That's a gift.
Jawatch still has a big goal ahead of him, becoming an international chess master. With his proficiency and patience, Proper and his peers have no doubt that will happen. Bernard Chessman, VOA News, Queens, New York.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Werkinger and our engineer Zinab Abdulrahman, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
North Korea, said U.S. Special Envoy for North Korean Human Rights Issues Robert King, is one of the worst human rights violators in the world. Over the last year, the international community has focused on North Korea's human rights abuses as never before. The Independent Commission of Inquiry, created by the UN Human Rights Council, presented a report of its comprehensive findings to the United Nations Human Rights Council last March, concluding that many of the abuses reported could rise to the level of crimes against humanity. Both the Human Rights Council and the UN General Assembly adopted strong resolutions calling for accountability for North Korea's human rights abuses. North Korea remains an authoritarian state. The government maintains a vast network of political prison camps. North Korean defectors and the international media continue to report public executions, disappearances, arbitrary detentions, arrests of political prisoners, and torture. Even today, entire families, up to three generations, are sent to the prison camps when some official determines, usually without trial. In light of these ongoing abuses, pressure on North Korea is mounting. The Commission of Inquiry report recommended the establishment of a field office under the office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to preserve and document evidence of atrocities in order to enable future accountability. Critical to bringing change to North Korea is increasing the flow of information into and out of one of the most closed societies in the world. There are reported to be over 2 million cell phones in North Korea, but these phones connect only domestic users and are closely monitored. Internet access is limited to a tiny circle of elites. But cracks in the information blockade are forming. The latest study by the U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors found that 35% of North Korean refugees and travelers had listened to foreign radio broadcasts inside North Korea, even though it is still illegal to possess a radio that can be tuned. Our deep concern for human rights in North Korea and for the well-being of the North Korean people, said Special Envoy King, reflects the American commitment to the rule of law and respect for individual rights. The world will not and cannot close its eyes to what is happening in North Korea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting February 2nd, we'll begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your answer. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.